Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Welcome to CSIS, and a special, special welcome to Undersecretary Tarur. We're delighted you are here. I should tell you how this happened. A very prominent friend of CSIS in New York contacted me and says, "Do you know Shashi?" And I said, "Well, I'm embarrassed to say no. I know lots of people who do, but I don't." And he said, "You know, he's going to be the next Secretary General. You need to get to meet him." And I said, "Well, I clearly do. You know, I absolutely do want to meet him." And this was an opportunity. So I contacted Shashi. This was back in July. And I was starting to realize how his calendar was filling up quite quickly, as everybody else in America and, frankly, around the world wants to meet this guy, too. And I'm delighted that he gave us a window here in September, the first part of September. It was important for me to be able to, not just because I'm trying to suck up in case you're the next Secretary General, to put it blunt, you know, but it's not that, as much as it is for Washington to start seeing the face of the UN again. You know, we've fallen in a bad pattern over the last 10 years or so, where the UN is a contracted four-letter word, you know, in American politics. I think because we're in so many difficulties these days, we're starting to realize that we need a UN. We probably need a better UN than we got, but that's up to us to help do it and not to walk away from the UN. And I think that's really one of the key questions that's in front of us. It's one of the reasons, Shashi, why I wanted you to be down here in Washington, to show a face to Washington and for Washington to start thinking its way through why it is that we need a UN and we need a constructive UN. And you're going to be, I think, a great spokesman today. You've been an astounding spokesman these last years, having been in charge of communications for the UN. But this is a man of great depth that underlies, you know, he's not just a communications guy. This is a guy who was in charge of some very difficult post-conflict reconstruction environments and did exceptionally well. He's had deep experience throughout the range of the UN environment and experience. He's got the kind of depth that we know the UN will need if he is going to be selected to be the Secretary General. I asked him, how the heck do we really pick it? It sounds like this is the only process that's more mysterious than picking a pope, you know, except there's no white smoke or black smoke. I think just fireworks when it's all over. So, Shashi, we're delighted that you're here. We do need to have this starting dialogue. I hope it may be a much deeper and richer dialogue over time. And you're going to help us a great deal, and we hope that you will look to Washington as being a source of strength and help for you. So without any further delay, I introduce to you the Secretary General of the United Nations, Shashi Tharoor.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Thank you, John. That really was a terrific introduction. And I must say that I share with you very strongly the view that the UN needs to be seen and heard from more in this fair city, and that I think if this occasion today has achieved an interaction between the UN and Washington and with all of you here, that in and of itself, I think, excuse me, will be a valuable event in and of itself. But I do want to say thank you all for being here. It's a genuine pleasure for me to address you under the auspices of the CSIS, an institution that has a reputation second to none as a home of serious and considered analysis of key global and social issues. And I do welcome the opportunity to discuss vital issues concerning the future of the United Nations here in Washington. Clearly, as one who hopes to be given the opportunity to serve the organization as we work together, and that together is important, to chart a course for our world into the second decade of the 21st century. Now, I know I scarcely need to tell anybody on the CSIS's mailing list that the United Nations started out as a vision in the minds of a handful of far-sighted men and women in 1945, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his successor, Harry Truman, principally amongst them, who were determined to make the second half of the 20th century different from the much-troubled first. So they drew up rules to govern international behavior. And in 1945, they founded institutions in which different nations could cooperate for the common good. Their idea, which we now call global governance, was to create an international architecture that could foster cooperation across nations, elaborate consensual global norms, and establish predictable, universally applicable rules to the benefit of all. As an alternative, and I'm practically paraphrasing FDR's speech here to Congress after Yalta, an alternative to the military alliances and balance of power politics that had wreaked such havoc in the preceding five decades. And the keystone to the arch was, of course, the United Nations itself. The UN was seen by those world leaders as the only possible answer to the disastrous experiences of those 45 years before they'd met. 45 years in which the world had suffered two world wars, countless civil wars, brutal dictatorships, mass expulsions of populations, and the horrors of the Holocaust and of Hiroshima. So the new United Nations that they were creating was meant to stand for a world in which people of different nations and cultures could look on each other, not as adversaries, as subjects of fear and suspicion, but rather as partners, able to exchange goods and ideas to their mutual benefit. A place where small states and big would be able to work as sovereign equals, pursuing common objectives in a universal forum. And of course, this United Nations was also meant to be a place to provide a means to address what we sometimes like to call these days problems without passports, the kinds of problems that cross all frontiers uninvited. You can name them: climate change, drug trafficking, epidemics, refugee movements, today terrorism, and whose solutions too can also have no passports, because no one country or one group of countries, however rich and however powerful, can tackle them alone. Now, it's the resolution of these problems that remains at the very core of the UN's activities. And standing here in Washington, I think it's fair to say that even those countries that once felt insulated from external dangers by wealth or strength or distance now realize that the safety of people everywhere depends not only on their local security forces, but on guarding against threats from elsewhere, guarding against terror, warding off the global spread of pollution, of disease, of illegal drugs, and of weapons of mass destruction, and promoting human rights, democracy, and development. Jobs anywhere depend not only on local firms and factories, but on faraway markets for the goods they buy and produce, on licenses and access from foreign governments, on an international environment that allows for the free movement of goods and persons, and on international institutions that ensure stability. In short, on the international system constructed in 1945. And so in 2006, I would argue that the need for a universal means of global governance, a mechanism for international cooperation, indeed, let's call it by its name, for a United Nations, is stronger than ever, as strong as it was in 1945. Which leads me to the next question. What kind of United Nations should we build for the future? Now, of course, part of the answer to that question, as John Hamery's comments already suggested, must lie in a frank examination of the past. And I think we have to admit right off that the UN has never been and will never be a perfect body. It has acted unwisely at times, it has failed to act at others, and we can each find examples in this room, I'm sure, of the UN setbacks and failures. But the United Nations at its best and its worst is a mirror of the world. It reflects not just our divisions and disagreements, but also our hopes and convictions. As our great Second Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld put it, the United Nations was not created to take mankind to heaven, but rather to save humanity from hell. And that it has. We must not forget that the United Nations has accomplished a great deal in the last 60 years. Most important of all, perhaps, in this capital, one can argue that it helped prevent the Cold War from turning hot. First, by providing a roof under which the two superpower adversaries could meet and engage with each other and with the rest of the world, and second, by mounting peacekeeping operations that ensured that local and regional conflicts were contained and did not ignite a superpower clash that could have sparked off a global conflagration. Today, while the Security Council grapples with Lebanon, the Palestinian situation, Iran, North Korea, the UN clearly remains at the heart of the challenges of world disorder and must respond effectively to them. Over the years, more than 170 UN-assisted peace settlements have ended regional conflicts. Over 300 international treaties have been negotiated at the UN, creating an international framework that has reduced the prospect for conflict among sovereign states. In fact, it's a little appreciated fact that right now, today, in the world, there is no single war going on between two sovereign states, not one. And that is an unusual fact in the history of the modern world. The UN has built global norms that are universally accepted in areas as diverse as decolonization and disarmament, development and democratization. And the UN remains second to none in its unquestioned leadership, experience and authority in coordinating humanitarian action, from tsunamis to human waves of refugees. When the blue flag flies over a disaster zone, all know that humanity is taking responsibility, not any one government, and that when the UN succeeds, the whole world wins. Our newly refurbished and replenished revolving fund for emergency response to humanitarian disasters both reflects and strengthens our ability to make a difference. And these are achievements we can build on. But since the best crystal ball is sometimes the rearview mirror, I hope you will allow me a personal look into the past as well. For the UN has not just changed enormously in these last 60 years, it has been transformed in the career span of the one UN official standing in front of you. If I'd even suggested to my seniors when I joined the organization 28 years ago that the UN would one day observe and even run elections in sovereign states, that the UN would conduct intrusive inspections for weapons of mass destruction, that it would impose comprehensive sanctions on the entire import-export trade of a medium-sized member state, that it would create a counter-terrorism committee to monitor national actions against terrorists, that it would send human rights monitors into a monarchy to see how the king was treating his own people, or it would set up international criminal tribunals and coerce governments into handing over their citizens to be tried by foreigners under international law. Well, I'm sure if I'd said any of these things to my seniors, they would have told me that I simply did not understand what the United Nations was all about. Because every one of those things would have seemed inconceivable to UN veterans of 1978. And yet the UN has done every one of those things during my span in that organization. I have seen the UN as a highly adaptable institution that has evolved effectively in response to changing times. And since it has worked in practice, my vision of the UN of the future is one that is firmly anchored in its own experience, even, and this is a horribly mixed nautical metaphor, even as it sails onward. But though our worlds are lined with Nobel Prize certificates, we must not rest on our laurels. We need reform, not because the UN has failed, but because it has succeeded enough to be worth investing in. And the need for reform has become clear in recent years, and we live in a time when divisions in the UN have led to genuine worries that the old East-West divide of the Cold War is being replaced by a new and equally serious North-South divide. Many diplomats and international academic observers are speaking increasingly of a crisis of confidence in the UN system. But you know, we speak a lot of languages at the UN. Indeed, I am the Secretariat's coordinator for multilingualism. And my Chinese friends tell me that in their language, the Chinese character for crisis is made up of two other characters, the character for danger and the character for opportunity. Today we must see the danger and we must seize the opportunity. A series of far-reaching proposals was made by the current Secretary General, and at the World Summit last year, the largest single gathering of heads of state and government in human history at any one time on our planet, agreed on a plan to reshape the international architecture for the 21st century. We have to build on that level of political agreement and take our organization forward in the common interest. And that is where the new Secretary General comes in. You know, 53 years ago, the first outgoing Secretary General, Trigvi Lee, described the post that he was handing over to Dag Hammarskjöld as the most impossible job in the world, a function described in the charter as the chief administrative officer of the organization, yet one with major unspecified political responsibilities and communications challenges. Today, the Secretary General commands great diplomatic legitimacy and even greater media visibility, but less political power than the language of the UN Charter suggests. To be effective, he must be skilled at managing staff and budgets, gifted at public diplomacy and its behind-the-scenes variant, and able to engage the loyalties of a wide array of external actors, including non-governmental organizations, business groups, think tanks, and journalists. And he must work well, above all, with governments. He must convince the poor and conflict-ridden nations of the South that their interests are uppermost in his mind, while ensuring that he can work effectively with the wealthy and powerful North. He must recognize the power and the prerogatives of the Security Council, especially its 5 permanent members, while staying attentive to the priorities and passions of the General Assembly. He must promote dialogue across the divides, geographic, political, ideological, and work with member states to search for common solutions. And he must present member states with politically achievable proposals and implement his mandates within the means they provide him. Above all, the Secretary General needs a vision of the higher purpose of his office and an awareness of its potential and its limitations. In other words, to be successful, he must conceive and project a vision of the UN as it should be, while administering and defending the organization as it is. Truly an impossible job. But understanding what it takes is the first step to doing it well. I come to you, dear friends, with 28 years of service to the United Nations in a wide variety of areas. Refugees and humanitarian work, peacekeeping, service in the Secretary General's office, and now the management of a large department that I'm proud to say I've been able to reform. In the process, I've seen, from the inside and the ground up, most of the major types of challenges that a Secretary General can expect to be faced with. I believe I can handle them well. I offer both continuity and change. Continuity with the best traditions of the United Nations. Change, because change, as I've described it to you, is a constant in our organization. I believe an effective United Nations is essential as the indispensable global institution for our globalizing world. And a vital task of the Secretary General, of the next Secretary General, will have to be to ensure that the institution is ready for the challenges of tomorrow, that this 20th century organization can take on the challenges of the 21st century, building indeed on the changes that Kofi Annan has already introduced, but prepared to deal with the unpredictable problems of tomorrow. Now let's have no illusion about the scale of the challenges. The divisions over the Iraq war dramatically affected the UN standing. Around the world, our image, in fact, went down in the U.S. because the U.N. did not support the administration on the war, and it went down in many other countries because the U.N. was unable to prevent the war. We disappointed both sets of expectations, and we've seen something similar happening with regard to Lebanon, where on the one hand the U.N. was attacked for seemingly giving aid and comfort to Hezbollah, while our offices in Beirut were trashed and set on fire by people feeling the UN was not doing enough to protect the victims in Lebanon. This phenomenon of standing sometimes in the middle of every debate and being run over from both sides is part of the challenge a Secretary General has to face. All the more ironic that the UN reflects, as I pointed out earlier, the realities of the world and the extent of our willingness to cooperate with and work with each other. Now, I'm happy to talk about all of this during our Q&A period, but as Secretary General, I would focus on those areas which are within the Secretary General's direct competence. None is more important than the reinforcement of the operational capacity of the United Nations to fulfill the Millennium Development Goals, to mount effective peacekeeping operations, and to respond urgently to crises. As the Chief Administrative Officer of the organization, a job assigned by the Charter, the Secretary General must ensure the strengthening of the international civil service, and I would insist that staff of both sexes of the highest competence and integrity are appointed to responsible positions and that due regard is paid so that The Secretariat fairly reflects the cultural diversity of our planet. At the same time, there can be no place for the cronyism and nepotism with which we have sometimes been not unfairly accused. I spoke of continuity and change. There is much of the UN that must continue. Our work in development, the work of our agencies in the field, humanitarian relief, crisis response, to take but three examples. We must continue to improve our ability to mount effective peacekeeping operations. I think we all recognize that currently they take too long to deploy and are uneven in quality. The UN is and must continue to be a forum where the rich and the powerful can commit their strength and their wealth to the cause of a better world. And it must continue to provide the stage where great and proud nations, big and small, rich and poor, can meet as equals to iron out their differences and find common cause in their shared humanity. The UN will only succeed as a recourse for all and not as the instrument of a few. And to be that, the UN must embrace sensible reform. Mahatma Gandhi once said, "You must be the change you wish to see in the world." What is true for individuals applies to institutions too. The UN is no exception. If we want to change the world, we must change too. And I respectfully suggest that managing change is best done by someone who knows how to do it, who values and respects the traditions and principles of the institution he serves, and who understands that at the UN, the diplomacy of management is sometimes as important as management itself. And a new Secretary General must also do everything possible to build on the reforms achieved in recent months. And we must promote democracy and good governance as essential to development. We now have a new democracy fund to help us do that, an idea that came from George Bush, but that has been financed not just by the rich West, but by countries like India. The UN must stand up for human rights everywhere, ensuring that the new Human Rights Council fulfills its responsibilities more effectively than the over-politicized Human Rights Commission that it replaced. And we must not let conflicts reignite when peacekeepers have left. We must work in the newly created Peacebuilding Commission to ensure that conflict gives way to development and to democratic institution building so that peace is truly sustainable. These are institutions in which member states and the Secretary General will have to work hand in glove. Equally important, the doubling of the budget of the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights will permit us to make a difference in operational terms where it counts, in the field, not just in the conference rooms in Geneva. Now, it's too early to say how effective all these recent innovations will be, and that's why it's a preoccupation of the new Secretary General, because the current one simply doesn't have enough time left to get these things moving. We all know the cliche that the proof of the pudding is in the eating, but at least I think we now have a recipe that should work. And there are other obvious tasks for a new Secretary General. The first is to ensure that the UN is organized to be ready to tackle a vast range of problems effectively, and to be prepared for new and completely unpredictable ones. 3 years ago, who had even heard of the grave risk of avian flu? As an immediate task, the new Secretary General must work together with states on the unfinished business of management reform, especially to ensure ethics, accountability, and transparency, together with truly independent audit oversight. I would focus on building issue-based coalitions across the North-South divide on specific practical problems: management inefficiencies, procurement policies, information technology, outsourcing, all areas that member states both North and South have an interest in, areas that have little to do with ideological politics. Now, if these recent changes and the steps forward that we can take with this unfinished business succeed, I believe we can set in place a structure that will allow us to move into the future with renewed confidence and allow the next Secretary General to concentrate on implementation. One word here in the capital of the richest country on earth: development. Development must be a major priority for the United Nations. Despite its remarkable successes in pulling millions out of poverty in recent years, Asia cannot afford to be complacent. Latin America is not much better off, and Africa continues to struggle. Let us not forget that at the World Summit, leaders from donor and developing nations alike made a strong and unambiguous commitment to achieving the Millennium Development Goals by 2015, and these, for the most part, are not on course to being met. The leaders devoted a separate section of their declaration to the compelling problems of Africa. We must hold them to their commitments and work to ensure that the world develops mechanisms that should make successful and sustainable development more likely. And not all of this will happen at the United Nations itself. The World Trade Organization, the Bretton Woods institutions, have a key role to play. But the UN remains indispensable as the place where political agreement can be reached on development goals, and where the agenda is set on issues that affect the well-being of the overwhelming majority of the world's people, and where the voice of each country is heard on that agenda. So I have, I hope, painted a picture of the United Nations of the future as one that's firmly anchored in its achievements, but eagerly engaged in transforming itself in the light of changing circumstances. A refurbished UN, built on the strong foundations laid down in 1945, buttressed by the innovations and achievements of the last 60 years, and renovated too to take account of the problems that we have uncovered in the course of dealing with the real challenges of the changing world outside. Realistically, it'll probably be a UN that is more sharply focused on areas where it has a proven and undoubted capacity to make a difference. It will, for example, continue to be the first port of call to coordinate the world's responses when major humanitarian disasters strike. It is currently the most successful practitioner and will likely remain the means of choice to monitor peace treaties. And when territories must be administered, while political solutions evolve and the modus operandi for lasting peace are established, the world will continue to turn to the UN, since it transcends any one government's interests but acts in the name of all. It will not, I imagine, lead military interventions, peacekeeping excepted, although its legislative bodies will undoubtedly remain the primary source of legitimacy for any such interventions. Well, where others have the capacity, the resources, and the will to keep the peace, the NATO in Afghanistan, the EU in Bosnia, but not yet, I fear, the AU in Darfur, the UN should stand aside and bless their efforts. And where the task, enforcing peace in Iraq, for instance, is clearly beyond us, we should offer political counsel and humanitarian assistance, but let wars be fought by warriors, not by peacekeepers. Above all, perhaps, I can see no other entity that could, with the same universality, the same efficiency, the same objectivity, provide the means to address the gaps and cracks in the facade of the international system, through which many of the 21st century's problems, from environmental degradation to global epidemics, to human rights abuses, to international terrorism, would otherwise prosper. So much then for the architecture. But as the old saying goes, a house is not a home. Something more, something extremely important, although not quite so tangible, is needed before we can be happy that our organization is all it can be in the 21st century. At this time of turbulence and transformation, it's a very simple thing. The new United Nations must encapsulate the 21st century equivalent of the spirit that informed its founding. We cannot afford to forget the ashes from which the UN was born in 1945. We have a duty to sustain this institution to ensure that the world is not again reduced to the ashes of that period 61 years ago. And so the UN must amplify the voices of those who would not otherwise be heard. It must serve as a canopy beneath which all can feel secure. And the UN of the future must never forget that it is both a result and a source of hopes for a better world, hopes that all human beings share. Now, to achieve this, those of us who work for the new UN must know when to speak up and when to listen. I think that there's little more valuable to a potential Secretary General than to hear the views and comments of those who care enough about the institution to come on a Washington afternoon to listen to him on that subject. So since I'm here to say that I hope to be at your service, and that I'm here to respectfully request the opportunity to be invited to serve, let me, in speaking, also underscore the importance of listening and turn the floor over to you for your own questions and comments. Thank you very much for giving me a hearing.
Thank you so much, Shashi Tharoor, for an inspiring as well as practical vision for what the UN might be and what you would like to do with it. The floor will now be yours, though I think I will exercise the privilege of the chair and kick things off. Let me ask, however, that when I do recognize you to ask a question, you wait for the microphone, and there are two or three of them walking around in the hands of exceptionally talented CSIS staff. Let me also ask you to identify yourself and to be brief, because if I know the CSIS audience, there will be lots of people behind you waiting to ask a question. Let me start off by picking up on one of the things that you identified as one of the key roles, one of the key competencies of the UN, which is mounting peacekeeping operations, and ask, if you were Secretary General, what additional tools, capabilities, resources would you like to see at your disposal to maximize the effectiveness of this kind of operation?
We have, fortunately, a very interesting prescription in the Brahimi Report of 2000, where Lakhdar Brahimi led a panel of distinguished experts who actually came up with some very constructive and detailed suggestions for reforming the peacekeeping efforts of the United Nations. Some of those have been implemented, some have not. And part of the challenge today is to see where we can take things forward in areas where clearly we have not been able to do as well as we'd like. One manifest problem is the speed of deployment. We simply don't get our soldiers out to operations quickly enough. It's striking that Henry Kissinger was talking about how in 1973, at the end of the Yom Kippur War, the first peacekeepers arrived in the Golan Heights within 48 hours. Well, part of the secret was the Pentagon provided free airlift for them to get out there. We don't have that anymore. We now have to go out and conduct tenders to see which is the cheapest way we can find companies that'll pay, I mean, that'll accept a modest payment to be able to take our soldiers somewhere. Governments, too, seem to have lost a little sense of the urgency behind the need to provide soldiers ready and able to move at very short notice. I think we need to get the world up and running on a much more dramatic, I don't want to use the word war footing, but let me say a peace footing, to be able to do this better. We have more peacekeepers now around the world than ever before in modern history. 86,000 under the UN's own umbrella, going up now in Lebanon by a further 10. We have, if the Darfur operation ever takes off, potentially another 17,000. We also have large numbers of soldiers serving under NATO and under the EU, who are not counted in the UN's figures. It's time we began, as an international community, to organize ourselves to mount, deploy, and command peacekeeping operations with the sort of effectiveness and professionalism that the world has always brought to the conduct of war. I think we really have to run peace as effectively as governments have run war in the past. I'd also very much like to improve our administration of the civilian side of things. It's striking that the UN Secretariat has 9,000 personnel around the world, and the civilian staff of peacekeeping are 17,000, almost double. That, again, is an area of our work in which we have to make sure that uneven quality is replaced by sustained professionalism. Finally, there's the intangible, and that's what governments on the Security Council are prepared to do. You know, Ambassador Schaefer, during my years in peacekeeping at the end of the Cold War from 1989 to 1996, I kind of evolved a formula from my own experiences, not always entirely happy experiences, during those turbulent years. And that formula was very simple, that peacekeeping success really depends on three things, of which, by the way, the first two depend on the third. The first is a mandate, a viable, realistic mandate of something that is worth doing and that can be done. The second is resources, human resources, financial resources, military resources that are commensurate with that mandate. And the third thing, without which the first two are impossible, is political will. It's a political will of governments on the Security Council, which give us our mandates and vote us the resources, a political will of those countries that provide the troops, the political will of the parties to the conflict where we are deployed. Without that political will, we will not have a mandate we can execute. We will not have the resources to do it with, and we will have failure. So that intangible is one beyond the control of any future Secretary General to deliver by himself. But I think it'll be part of my job, if elected, to keep reminding governments not to send us in unless they have the political backbone to support us all the way.
Bill Clark, and there should be a mic making its way to you.
Thank you. Undersecretary, let me ask a follow-on question to that, really. There has been talk in the past of having a standing force for the United Nations, which would, I assume, include airlift as well. But what are the prospects of that, and what are your views on actually the implementation of such a policy?
I'm afraid, the prospects are so remote as to make indulging in a fantasy about that unproductive. In other words, many of us, I think Sir Brian Urquhart, soon after he left peacekeeping, did a famous article in the New York Review of Books calling for the UN to have its own equivalent to the Foreign Legion. And one can understand the attractions of that. Rapid deployment, troops available at short notice, not hamstrung by political debates in parliaments about whether troops should be provided, and all of that. But the fact is that I'm not sure that there is enough traction in the international community to provide the United Nations with that sort of capacity. Certainly, I don't believe in Washington we're going to get much support for the idea of a standing UN force. And I think, apart from what one might call the ideological objections to giving the UN that sort of capacity, let me say that there are some important practical considerations as well. If the UN had its own army, it would have to pay for it, maintain it, house it, train it, handle entire systems of promotion and discipline, which right now are run by national armies. And at what point would it be capped? If we had a UN force of 5,000 or 10,000, they would have been long since deployed. We wouldn't have needed them when the next crisis came along. But we can't realistically ever imagine the kinds of resources it would take to have a UN standing force of 86,000, the number of troops we have in the field today. So for those reasons, I just think that idea will not work. What would work better would be if governments as member states of the United Nations were prepared to put their soldiers on a state of readiness, of stand-by rather than standing capacity, so that they could deploy, be made available much more quickly, and could deploy at a moment's notice.
Yes, the gentleman right here in the second row.
Thank you. My name is Nikolai Zimin, Russian weekly magazine Itogi. Maybe my question is very undiplomatic, but it's the first question which comes to my mind. Mr. Tarur, how do you consider your own chances to become next UN Secretary? I mean only one, you know, small thing. Can you imagine the situation in which China will support the candidate for so important, a visible post as a Secretary General for the person from India? Thank you.
Thank you. No, I think you should ask undiplomatic questions. Let me encourage others to follow his example. First of all, as far as my chances are concerned, I doubt you ever come across a candidate who didn't believe his chances were good. I can assure you that I'm no exception to that rule. I believe I have a decent chance, and I've had a straw poll behind us that took place in July, which was shortly after I'd entered and before I'd had much of a chance to campaign, as it were, in which I came a close second to the front runner, the Foreign Minister of the Republic of Korea. So I'm reasonably pleased with that result, and I've been going on from there. On the second question, I can assure you that, of course, I'm conscious of the fact that not only do you need a convincing majority in the Security Council, you need to avoid a veto from one of five countries that possess a veto. And I can assure you that, as far as I'm concerned, I have every reason to believe that there is no reason for me to think that I should not be a candidate because a particular country that you've mentioned would not be happy with that. I think that these are consultations that need to take place before candidates put themselves forward, and on that basis I'm quite, comfortable with the idea that the countries that will be pronouncing on my future know what I have to offer them.
Over here, William Bruin, white shirt.
My name is Daniel Rob R. Daniels. My question is, looking forward, maybe for the next 20 years, the United Nations, by its charter, of course, is focused on nation states. And we talk a lot these days about failing states, etc. But so many of the forces that have emerged since the founding of the United Nations are not national in nature. They're commercial business forces. They're religious forces, ideological forces. Do you have a concept of how the United Nations, with its charter context, can better address, engage those other mighty forces that may be, in fact, as powerful as nation states going forward?
Yes, in fact, that's a very good question, and it's absolutely pertinent to the challenges that any Secretary General would face at the beginning of the 21st century. Non-state actors in every domain, incidentally, even in the peace and security domain, where I talked about there being no war between states, but there's plenty keeping us busy in wars with irregulars and with non-state actors fighting states and other non-state actors. But apart from peace and security, there are the challenges you've mentioned and the opportunities that you've implicitly highlighted. Engagement with the business community is relatively new for the UN, but it took place and has begun effectively under the leadership of the current Secretary General, Kofi Annan, with the creation of the so-called Global Compact, which gets private sector firms to sign on to principles that, in fact, have already been adopted by governments, principles of human rights, of labor standards, and of environmental protection, and now, indeed, of anti-corruption, which has been added to the list. Now, that's one way of engaging with the private sector, but we can certainly do more with them. And that's certainly an initiative that I would like to continue and build on. We've come a long way from the days when the UN had a center on transnational corporations that was widely known as the Center Against Transnational Corporations. I think that we now recognize that in today's world, the private sector has an enormously valuable contribution to make, indeed, to the very process of development, where private sector capital flows vastly outstrip what governments are able to give in development assistance. There's also, as you've correctly pointed out, non-governmental organizations, civil society institutions of various sorts. I'm proud that in my current function as head of the Department of Public Information, I've had to engage a great deal with these groups. And I found them refreshing, often committed, sometimes more idealistic than practical diplomats can afford to be, but extremely important to engage with because they represent, if you like, the unmediated public opinion of ordinary people around the world. And then, of course, we have various other forms, organized, disorganized, people out on the streets and people on the web and the internet, who all have their own contributions to make to discussing the challenges facing the world, and in some ways helping to provide the UN both with sources of support and sources of criticism. Now, we probably can't deal with every one of those, but we will certainly, I think, have to make an effort to engage with them, to recognize they're out there, and to see what we can do in partnership with them to carry them along with us. So thank you for bringing that to the attention of this group.
Yes, over here in the third row, gentleman in the dark shirt.
Thank you. Suzanne?
If you could stand up so we can see you.
Sure. David Turnbull. My question is, do you think the current structure of the Security Council is able to handle the changing and challenging nature of things that will face the UN in the coming century, in the coming years? And if not, do you see any prospects for change to that structure?
Right. Well, in fact, there's no question that the Security Council reflects far more the geopolitical realities of 1945 than of today. The issue of change has actually been on the table since 1992, when the General Assembly set up an open-ended working group on Security Council reform. Though now, 14 years later, it's been widely and disrespectfully referred to as the never-ending working group on Security Council reform. But I don't mean to be facetious. The fact is there are important issues. It's one of these problems, sort of rather like a malady, in which the doctors all gather around a patient. They all agree on the diagnosis, but they can't agree on the prescription. The diagnosis is indeed that there are real anomalies and anachronisms. Mathematically, there's a problem. I mean, the fact is, in 1945, the Security Council was 11 members out of a total UN membership of 51. So 22% of the UN was in the Security Council. Today, it's 15 members out of a total UN membership of 192, less than 8%. And that means that a larger percentage of the membership, as well as an absolute number of states, feel that they're not adequately represented on that body. Then you've got the geographical balance within the council, which still reflects much more a world that is past than the world of today. After all, Europe, 5% of the world's population, has 33% of the seats in the council. This year, the Secretary General will be elected by a 15-member council, five of whose members are members of the European Union. That's astonishing. I mean, we all love the European Union and respect it. It's an institution that, in many ways, stands for the values and principles that the UN completely shares. But where does that leave the rest of the world? You can well imagine the questions being asked in other regions of the world. And then the permanent membership has become a question too, because while five permanent members have an important place in the council, there are other countries whose contributions to the international community in the last 60 years, financial contributions to the UN, peacekeeping contributions, development contributions, and so on, seem not to have been recognized in the structure of the council. Now, all of that is a diagnosis, but in arriving at a prescription, we have a problem. And the problem is quite simply that the bar set by the Charter, the threshold set to amend the Charter, is an extremely high threshold indeed. It requires a framework for change to be adopted by two-thirds membership of the General Assembly, two-thirds of the membership of the General Assembly, and then that has to be ratified, and ratification in most countries is a parliamentary process, so it has to be ratified by two-thirds of the world's parliaments, including those of all five permanent members. So passing a resolution, two-thirds, which is tough enough, is not enough. It has to be a resolution which you know will pass through the U.S. Senate and the Chinese People's Consultative Congress and the French Parliament and so on and get ratified in a way that it can be implemented. Until you have such a formula, the short answer is there isn't a concrete way forward for countries to fulfill their aspirations to serve on a larger or more representative council. So as Secretary General, if elected, that is not a subject that I can do very much about other than draw attention to it. The member states are the only ones who can decide because it's their political will that will determine whether a framework can be agreed on the basis of which such a solution can be found.
Way over on this side.
Thanks for your very candid remarks, Sasha. One of the main themes...
Can you identify yourself and your affiliation, please?
Yes, I'm Michael Hrstishin from the U.S. Agency for International Development. One of the main themes that you focused on today was peacekeeping operations, and I'd like to go back to a remark that you made earlier with regards to the importance of professionalism for the civilian staff in peacekeeping operations. Many of those individuals now are on series 100 or 300 contracts. Typically, they're on with the operations for 6 months, and then they're renewed. I'd be interested in your thoughts about the professionalization of those people, whether there's a career track for them, whether they should be brought in as permanent staff members of the United Nations, and how you see their growth as a very important ingredient in the success for the UN in peacekeeping operations.
Thank you. No, I agree entirely that this is exactly what needs to be done. We have created a sort of caste system where the people working in the so-called regular budget positions of the United Nations have security of tenure, predictability, various benefits, and people doing the tougher jobs out in the field in peacekeeping, for the most part, are people on the kinds of contracts you describe. And that simply is wrong. It simply should not be allowed to continue. We have to recognize that we are no longer an organization which people join because they want to run conferences or conduct important negotiations alone. Those are all important things we need to do, but we also have to recognize that being a UN official ought to involve an opportunity to make a difference out in the field and to bring your knowledge of headquarters to work in the field, and indeed in turn to bring your knowledge of work in the field to headquarters. We don't have that yet, and I think there are immediate steps that can and should be taken to creating both a larger cadre of personnel who will be able to translate their peacekeeping experience into further service in that area, but also to create conditions of service which will permit much more permeability between those in the regular budget type positions and the ones in peacekeeping. I think a lot of our functions at headquarters are functions that need to be replicated in the field. We need legal officers in the field just as much as we need them in New York. We need administrators in the field as much as we need them in New York. There is no reason whatsoever to have two different kinds of categories of people. We should have one set of people who are able to do the good job, and most countries' foreign services certainly run that way. There's no reason why we at the UN shouldn't. Well, there is a reason, and that part of that reason is the entrenched structural issues which have led to the situation we're in today, as well as the costs that would be involved in transforming it. But those would be one-time costs, and I'd like to work with the governments to ensure that we can do this in a way that doesn't come as too much of a sort of sticker shock problem for member states, but that can transform the UN over a period of years, but not too many years, say over a period of 4 or 5 years, into a truly mobile, efficient, and integrated civil service.
Yes, there's a lady in black at the back of the room on this side.
Hi, Laura Stein with Internews. I wanted to ask about your current department, the Department of Public Information, as communication is a critical tool for building public support and political will. What, if you can talk about reforms that you've overseen in that department and what else you think needs to change to improve broad communication with the public.
Thanks very much. Yes, I did indeed go into that department with a mandate of reform, and I'm very pleased to say that that is indeed what I was able to do. I started off, in fact, when I walked in, by asking, what is the mandate of this department? And I was handed 38 pages of extracts of General Assembly resolutions. That's the way in which we've traditionally done our work. The General Assembly keeps passing resolutions that invite the UN's information department to increase worldwide awareness of the problems of outer space, or to create information materials on the difficulties of straddling migratory fish stocks. Now, all of this is important, I'm sure, but if you have long lists of priorities like that, basically nothing gets done. And what becomes essential then is to have a different vision of what it is that you are there to do in the information business. Well, that's what I started telling my staff. I said, you're not here to write a press release or design a website or, you know, print a poster. You're here in the knowledge that without your work, the substantive purposes of the United Nations would not succeed. In other words, the peacekeepers, for example, would not be able to succeed if without the information work you're doing, countries didn't understand what the peacekeepers were trying to accomplish, the populations amongst whom they were deployed didn't know what they were doing, the troop contributors had no incentive to continue supplying the troops, countries in the council didn't want to continue voting for them to continue, and so on. So the reorientation became what I suppose in management jargon we'd call a client orientation in our department. We basically turned to the substantive parts of the UN and said, you're our clients, you're the Department for Disarmament, you're the Department for Humanitarian Affairs, tell us what are the big issues you want us to be able to project for you. And that was the major transformation that I started off with. I also came up with a new operating concept for the department, a new operating model, hived off bits of the department I felt we could do without, including the much-prized cartographic unit, which I thought really belonged in the peacekeeping department and not in public information, and proceeded to close some offices in the field, something which I'm pleased to say almost nobody else I know of in the UN has successfully done, but I'm not entirely pleased to say it because I still bear the scars. Countries are usually in favor of reform, in theory, but very rarely in their own backyards. And it was not easy going to be able to consolidate our presences, for example, in Western Europe into one regional center and close some offices in the interests of efficiency in a budget-tight environment. Further, I tried to bring in a culture of evaluation that we didn't have in the Secretariat before, where each of the managers was trained in producing something called an annual performance impact review. Every year, they have to evaluate the impact of the products and services for which they're responsible, and they don't just do this as a paper exercise, they actually have to present and defend this in front of the other managers in the department. And all this was a way of trying to move the department forward into an atmosphere of efficient, purposeful action so we could actually get results for the objectives that we were set. I think that reform is always an unfinished business. There's always more to be done. But I think in these few years, I have been able to get the department into better shape than it was before, and I've discovered how much can be done, even despite the limits and constraints of the General Assembly's rules and practices.
The gentleman here in the bright blue necktie.
Thank you. Well, I guess I chose the right tie. Howard LaFranchi with the Christian Science Monitor. We have two high-profile situations right now where countries are snubbing Security Council mandates. Of course, Iran, refusing to cease enrichment of uranium, and then Sudan, which is not accepting, at least for now, peacekeeping force. I'm wondering if you see this kind of defiance of the UN increasing, why that might be, and what, as Secretary General, you might be able to do in that kind of situation.
Thank you. And I might say that though I've never met Mr. Howard LaFranchi, I've enjoyed your pieces for quite a while now. Your byline frequently features in the UN's press clipping service, so you have a readership in our building. On the two issues you raise, I think these are both serious ones, and they do demonstrate some of the limitations of how much any international organization can impact upon the decisions of sovereign states. In the case of Iran, as you know, the Security Council unanimously resolved that Iran had to stop doing certain things by a certain date. Iran has apparently not yet done so, and therefore there is a question now of how the Security Council will react. Now, this is a matter for governments, not for the Secretary General, but the governments are busy consulting each other. I know there are meetings taking place even today in Europe as we speak, and that the process of consultation is bound to lead to some decisions which will be aiming at promoting compliance from Iran with the demands of the international community. Is that defiance, or is that a normal process of member states bargaining with each other? That becomes almost a definitional issue. But I wouldn't speak of it as if there is some sort of repudiation by Iran of the entire United Nations, because Iran works within the United Nations on a whole host of other issues day after day. And it's not been that long, a couple of days, since Secretary General Kofi Annan was received by President Ahmadinejad in Tehran to discuss the problems in Lebanon. So Iran remains, as a member state, a key partner of the United Nations, and I would try not to lose sight of that, even if on this particular issue it is not indeed in compliance with what the Council has demanded. On the subject of Sudan and Darfur, there is no question that both in theory and in practice, the right of a sovereign state to refuse to receive foreign troops is something we would all have to recognize and live with. I say in theory, and that of course comes from the Charter, the prerogatives of states, but also in practice, because what's the alternative? If a state of any size says to you, I'm sorry, I'm not going to allow your troops to come in, the only way you can go in is essentially by going to war with that state. And at this stage, I'm unaware of a single member state of the United Nations that is prepared to or is contemplating going to war with Sudan to get its troops in to keep a peace that it will then have violated. So the bottom line is both a theoretical one and a practical one. You do have to decide, what exactly is permissible on the part of states in the ways in which they treat their own people. We have just less than a year ago seen the world leaders adopting the responsibility to protect as a norm. And clearly, when citizens of a country are not being protected, there is a duty on the part of the international community to draw attention to it. But there is no realistic, practical, or legally justifiable way for the international community to push troops into a country against the wishes of that sovereign country's rulers.
Gentlemen, most of the way back. Yes, you, sir.
Nitin Madhav with USAID. My question is, as you yourself said, there are currently no conflagrations between two sovereign powers. How then would the UN change itself to deal with non-state actors such as Hezbollah and other issues that may come up in the future? Thank you.
Thank you, Nathan. Good to see you here. There's a brave young man who lost a limb trying to protect vulnerable people in Africa, and I'd like to congratulate you for being here. I just want to say that as far as actors like Hezbollah are concerned, we have had to deal with them in practice in a number of situations. I mean, we've been deployed in southern Lebanon for years. It's not as if we have, in the past, not had to engage with important groups that are indeed not only not states, but in some cases exist in opposition to states. That's not the case of Hezbollah, which is two ministers, two cabinet ministers in the Lebanese government. But there are other entities we've had to deal with over the years in different parts of the world. I think there is a distinction to be drawn between the formal relationship that the United States has with its member states, and the United Nations has with its member states, and the practical arrangements by which UN operations in the field deal with whoever can be an asset or an impediment to their work. And that applies to our humanitarian operations, our development projects, and indeed to our peacekeeping operations. We do deal with whoever we have to deal with to get the job done.
Further over there, gentleman in the blue shirt. Yes, you, sir.
Hello, Dr. Tharoor. My name is Tony Fleming, editor of UNSG.org. You've mentioned in recent weeks that this is the most transparent process ever in the selection of Secretary General, a job for which one used not to have to campaign. Finding yourself in that position, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your campaign strategy, and specifically meetings that you have held with government leaders, ambassadors, and foreign ministers. Were they limited to Security Council members, to regional groups, and how were they organized?
Thank you, and Tony Fleming, and I'm also meeting for the first time, runs a very fine website called UNSG.org, which I must say I don't often have enough time to look at, but people who do look at it tell me it's the gold standard these days on SG elections. So congratulations, and let's all hope that it itself becomes an embodiment of the transparency that you're asking about. But in fact, that transparency is important, and I think it's important to take a few minutes to discuss this issue, because this year we have seen a process that has indeed been more transparent than any Secretary General election that I'm aware of in the past. It's striking, when the year began, in fact, people in New York began to comment that the World Economic Forum in Davos had a panel with the then three declared candidates and two putative candidates, in which they were able to lay out their visions for the organization and take questions from an audience largely comprising of businessmen, when that practice was not even followed by the United Nations in New York. And ambassadors started saying, but why shouldn't we? And why is it that the Security Council meets behind closed doors and discusses whatever names that have come to them by some mysterious process, and suddenly out of nowhere emerges this rabbit out of a hat who's going to run the Secretariat for the next few years? I mean, why should it be that way? And that questioning led to some real restiveness on the part of the membership as a whole. There was a very interesting Canadian paper which laid out very clearly, I think, some of the areas of discontent that some member states had felt with their being excluded from an important process in the selection of a Secretary General. And there was even a serious discussion of a draft resolution that would have required the Security Council to send more than one name to the General Assembly, because the Charter says the Secretary General is appointed by the General Assembly on the recommendation of the Security Council. But in these seven Secretary General elections so far, only the recommendation of the Security Council has mattered. Footnote, renewal of Trygve Lie, different, but we can talk about that separately with the historians in the room. But otherwise, only the recommendation of the Security Council has mattered. And that recommendation, of course, has always been a one name. And the Council has been doing that on the basis of a General Assembly resolution that asked the Council to do that. So some governments had it seen, but why can't the General Assembly take away what it is given by passing a new resolution asking for more than one name? Now, all of this restiveness clearly had an impact on the process. And the Security Council responded to this by saying, hold it, don't break all the china. We can actually respond to the need for transparency by being more open about what we're doing. There was the decision by the presidency in June, the Danish presidency, to meet with the presidency of the General Assembly and write to all member states saying, we will discuss in July names of candidates for the Secretary Generalship that will be submitted to us by member states. So suddenly, member states woke up and said, okay, there is a process. We nominate people. Let's do that. And four member states did so immediately. Then there was the so-called straw poll. We as candidates were formally encouraged by the Security Council to present ourselves to member states and regional groups. I actually got a call from the July presidency of the Security Council saying, we know the straw poll comes a bit soon for you since you've just announced, but in any case, we are encouraging candidates to go off and meet with member states. Why don't you do that? And I've taken them at their word, and indeed I am, as you say, campaigning. I've taken leave of absence. I'm using up pretty much every day of leave I've earned since I joined the UN 28 years ago, but I am in the process putting out my message. And not just to governments, I might add. I mean, I have had the privilege of meeting with government leaders, principally foreign ministers, really, in many countries, mostly but not exclusively Security Council members, because if a government is interested in talking to me, I'm interested in talking to them. After all, eventually, I would hope to be Secretary General of all 192 countries and their stake in the organization. But also, I found it valuable to have this kind of public discussion. The regional group meetings have been terrific. They were closed-door meetings. But that was, in each case, I can only speak of my own experience, about 2 to 2.5 hours of genuine give and take with ambassadors, starting off with something like a 20-minute statement by me, and then real exchange of questions, even tougher and more undiplomatic, sir, than the one you mentioned you were asking, which actually meant that even if nothing else comes out of this, and certainly only one of us, and maybe not even one amongst us, can triumph in this process, the process will have at least prompted a serious degree of reflection on the part of members of the organization about its nature, its purpose, its future direction, that can only be healthy, whatever becomes the outcome.
Lady in the red suit.
Rida Fakhri with Al Jazeera International. Mr. Tarur, as you well know, over the last few years, one of the main concerns expressed by member states of the United Nations, member states from the South, those who make up the bulk of the membership of the General Assembly, is that their voices are increasingly ignored or marginalized, and that this has happened to the advantage of member states in the Security Council, particularly those from the North, permanent members of the Security Council. What would you do as Secretary General to better reflect the views of the developing world, given the increasing influence of the U.S. and other permanent members of the Council, on the political decision-making at the UN? On a personal note as well, could you give us an idea of what you think is the one quality that would make you a better Secretary General than the other candidates vying for the post?
Thank you, Gita. Gita is an old friend, so she can get away with a question like that. One quality. What's the one quality that makes you a better journalist than anybody else, Gita? let me say very seriously that the question you raise is a serious one, because I have been alarmed to see the old east-west divide now seemingly giving way to a north-south divide in the organization, a divide that has been growing in the last couple of years, and that seemed to crystallize around the question of management reform this year. And it does go down, quite rightly, as you implied in your question, to a question of, shall we say, turf within the organization, of power, the balance of power within the organization. A perception that the UN had rested for a long time on a powerful Security Council, powerful in the peace and security area, and a powerful General Assembly, powerful in the norm-setting area and in the finance and budget of the organization. And that the tilting of this power balance has been in favor of the countries on the Security Council, in particular, therefore, the permanent members, at the expense of the larger membership. This diagnosis, whether it's accurate or not, is very much part of the perception of many countries of the G77. But very clearly, this has to be taken into account by a new Secretary General. I think for that reason, it's important that a new Secretary General be from a country of the G77, a country, in my own case, which has had a voice in that body, and therefore would be able to bring a certain perspective of both sympathy and belonging to the process of discussion within the organization. But equally, I think one will have to address some of the specific issues that have resulted in that sort of concern. Let me give you one example. In the reform package that was put forward earlier this year, which, as you know, most graphically resulted in this divide with a 120-50 vote, with all the countries of the G77 voting on one side and all the countries of the West voting on the other, which is really most unfortunate and must be pulled back from. In that package, there was a proposal that's been called the governance proposal, which was that the point was made that the Secretariat tends to be micromanaged by member states in the Fifth Committee, and instead of having all 192 countries going over every detail of our budget, why not have a smaller committee of countries which would do all the work and then report to the larger membership? And that created a huge uproar from the G77. And a moderate colleague, the South African ambassador, said rather emotionally, "I have spent my entire life fighting the notion that a small group of people can decide for the rest of us." Now, the moment he said that, we were on terrain where no one can win. I mean, you were on an emotional, political terrain which goes right beyond the issues of micromanagement or management efficiency into something quite different. My own attitude would be to pull that proposal right back and tear it up. As far as I'm concerned, that is not a debate that is worth creating heartburn over. If it means that my staff and myself would have to spend that many longer hours answering questions from 192 ambassadors and having member states take that many more bites of the management cherry, that is a price that I believe we should be prepared to pay to run an organization that truly belongs to all member states. Because the ultimate objective is not just in that particular instance efficiency, but a sense of belonging, the sense that every country, however small, feels it has a stake in the organization. And I'd be prepared to pay that price. So that's one example, but we can give you I can give you several more of ways in which I think a Secretary General, through a process of listening and a process of understanding where the concerns are, can redress this balance of worry about the way in which the power within the organization lies. Of course, a Secretary General has to work very closely with the Permanent Five. There's no question about that, particularly since on so many peace and security issues, they are both as indispensable partners and the ones who can do most to prevent serious accomplishment. But at the same time, the Secretary General must be accountable to the entire membership, and that is going to be very much my calling card. On the one quality, I won't try and answer that question. I'd like to think of myself as a composite package. 28 years of experience, various specific skills, a track record I can stand on, a long paper trail. I hope a safe pair of hands, somebody from whom people need not expect too many unusual or unexpected surprises because they've seen me tested in various crucibles. And I hope, finally, somebody who really cares passionately about this organization, about the values and principles it stands for, and will try and use that caring to articulate a vision of it to the world, which I hope might inspire some more faith in the UN.
Lady in black right here, second row.
Excellent answer, sir. I would vote for you if I had a vote.
Thank you. Let's quickly get you onto the Security Council.
You're welcome to, sir. I'm Melissa Sinclair from the National Defense University, and my curiosity was piqued by your comment on development at the end of your talk. And this is a very basic question, forgive me for oversimplifying a complex issue, but you made reference to the richest nations in the world, to the WTO, to Bretton Woods, all these different things, but really, sir, what are the major obstacles to development, and what can the UN do about those things?
Well, there are very many major obstacles to development. There's everything from the dead weight of history, of distortions that have occurred in many developing countries, often during the colonial period and after. There's the fault, if we can use that word, of developing country governance itself, where in many cases the practices of governance have not kept up with the needs of people. Corruption has been in many cases endemic and has been a problem. There have been some basic problems arising from resource scarcity. When you just don't have enough to be able to invest to bring about change, change is slow to follow. All of these elements and more have to be taken into account. As you know, development economists have argued for years over what the right mix is and the right formula is, and I don't think any Secretary General is going to consider himself to be the repository of all the received wisdom about how to move forward. National governments must take ownership of their own national development strategies. And the UN must be prepared to offer them good examples of best practices that have worked, but leave it to them to bring about their own results and to merit, therefore, more assistance to improve the results they brought about. I've gone into a little more detail on this in a response to a questionnaire that an NGO coalition sent out to the candidates. It's up on their website at unsgselection.org, and it's up on my website as well at shashitharoor.com. There are no magic bullets in development, but I think it is really a shame that after all these years, with the technology, the resources, the ideas that are around in the world, that still so many people go to bed hungry, that so many people try to make do on less than a dollar a day. It doesn't need to be that way.
White shirt, sir, towards the back.
I am Josh Silva from Council for Community of Democracies. I just want to thank you for taking my question. And you touched a little bit on democratization and UN promotion of it. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little about what you think the role in the future would be for the Democracy Caucus.
Thanks. Democracy Caucus, you said? Oh, I see. No, I thought you were going to ask about the Democracy Fund, which is within the Secretary General's capacity to strengthen, to lead, to push, and I will do all of that. The Democracy Caucus idea is a different one, and that's a political idea to try and get a few countries together as democracies to sort of serve as a kind of lobbying group within the UN and in international affairs. And I must say that while there are some advantages to such an idea, there are some obvious disadvantages as well. One of which is that it's in the nature of democracies not always to agree with each other, so that the Democracy Caucus as a caucus will necessarily see all issues the same way remains to be seen. And whether they'll work together to pursue common issues also remains to be seen. The second is most democracies also have other allegiances, and that those other allegiances sometimes will dictate the positions they take. The members of the EU are all democracies, but as a caucus, they do tend very often to concert their positions as the EU and have one person speak on behalf of the EU. Are they going to suddenly give that up to do this as part of a democracy caucus? I'm not so sure. There are democracies like India, which attach a lot of importance to the role of the non-aligned movement or in the G77. Would they allow loyalty to a democracy caucus to trump the positions they've taken in these movements? I'm not so sure. So for all of those reasons, these are interesting ideas that member states should pursue. There are always various ways in which they can organize themselves. But to me, the work of democratization that really matters is democratization in the field in countries around the world. There are many countries that really have become democracies and are struggling to strengthen their democracies, but that need resources, expertise, money, advice from an institution that is not tainted by being, shall we say, the agent of the foreign policy of any one country. And that's the great advantage the UN brings to the table when we do democratization. We can have, through the Democracy Fund, assistance given which may not even involve, for example, let's put it bluntly, a Western advisor landing in an African country to tell them how to do something. You might have, if somebody wants to set up an independent electoral commission in a new democracy, you might have very useful advice coming from India. You might turn to Sweden to tell you how to set up an ombudsman if you want to. These are the various ways in which the UN can pull together best practices from different parts of the world and encourage countries, therefore, to learn from and develop and strengthen their own democratic practices and aspirations.
Yes, here in the third row. You've got a mic coming. And if you could identify yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Colonel Tim Cornett from the U.S. Army Peacekeeping and Stability Ops Institute. To give you some context to my question, I served at UNDPKO for 3 years as a planner.
When were you there?
From 2000 to 2004. My question builds on some of your observations of the huge increase in peacekeeping, the number of forces deployed, the changing environment peacekeepers are in, but also brings about the question about reforming the staff or improving the actual staff at DPKO and the Secretariat. I know you're aware, but one of the challenges we have with managing peacekeeping missions that the UN has is there's a military division of, I think, 86 officers seconded, and those 86 are divided among four different services, and they rotate on usually on a three-year basis, so you have a 30% turnover rate. Do you think that is the kind of structure that can competently cope with the challenges of 18 or 19 missions and 100,000 peacekeepers deployed?
That's a good question. I'm assuming that your answer is embedded in the question, Carol. I think we need to look at all of that. In fact, there is no doubt as to why this is the case. It's because we can't take on serving military officers full-time on our staff, so they have to be seconded. And most militaries are reluctant to second their soldiers, particularly officers of a certain rank, beyond a certain period of time. It's often not in the interest of the officers, too, if they want promotion back in their national services. And that gives you some of the challenges we'd have to face in rethinking that. But point noted, and I will certainly give it some thought when I get back to deal with these issues. Let me add one more thought on peacekeeping, which I intended to when Teresita asked me that question. And that is quite simply that there is one other development since my time in peacekeeping, which is 10 years before yours, that I think needs to be reversed. And that is the fact that 90% of our peacekeepers in the field today are all from the South. When I was in peacekeeping, UN peacekeeping looked like the United Nations. I mean, we had Brits and French and Canadians and Irish and Scandinavians all serving under the blue flag. Today, they're not. And that, I think, is extremely worrying. And I think it's extremely important that if part of the problem is we haven't built up sufficient confidence in our command structures and in the way in which we run peacekeeping to give these countries a reason to come in under the blue flag, then we better get our act together and do that. Because I think it's extremely important, as we're seeing with Lebanon now, that countries from all parts of the world serve in peacekeeping so that the United Nations-ness of peacekeeping is always preserved.
We are running close to the end of our time, and I'm afraid we only have time for one more question, and I'm going to take this gentleman here in the second row.
Mr. Tarur Paramesh Warren from Agence France-Presse. Just a quick follow-up to the question on Iran.
What is the threshold for diplomacy in resolving the Iranian question, which has, one, been around for a long time, and two, which is a very sensitive issue in relation to nuclear?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by threshold. I mean, after all, as you said, diplomacy has gone on for a while yet on this area, and we've actually seen the sort of P5 plus one, that is the Germans, are being actively involved. We've seen the EU3 traveling to Tehran. We've seen a Security Council presidential statement and a Security Council resolution. And now the question is, how do we actually move in terms of what should be done to promote compliance with that resolution? That is a process that is actually underway. So in that sense, the threshold has been crossed in the sense that diplomacy is being used. If that's, I mean, I've misunderstood the nature of your question. If you mean when is the threshold for which diplomacy should be given up and something else tried, I mean, obviously working at the UN, we're in favor of trying diplomacy all the time. By and large, it tends to produce results.
Well, let me ask you to join me in giving a big thank you to Mr. Shashi Tharoor. And however the next few months unroll, I hope this will not be the last time we see you here at CSIS. Thanks so much for being with us today.